Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And we know that voice. He had a little bit to do with our subject today, Bobby Kennedy. That was his best buddy, Lyndon Johnson. They were not best buddies, believe me. It doesn't take long for history to be overtaken by myth. When a perceived great man is assassinated, from that dramatic moment on, actual history doesn't stand a chance. Abraham Lincoln, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and then Bobby Kennedy all became larger than their actual lives, and ever since, the mythic hero who stood in place of what would have been a very different historiography had the brave hero and the shining white steed not been so tragically cut down. When myth takes over from history, an intentional erasure begins. American school kids are fed a steady diet of myth, which does serve to bolster patriotism and a sense of pride in our identity. Myth certainly has its place. Every nation knows how important it is to raise generations to see their country the way the current powers insist. And there does seem to be some universal psychological need for heroes. Bobby Kennedy's case is a bit unique. Still in the ascent, when he was killed the night he won the crucial California primary back in 1968, 50 years ago, we can only mythologize so much. Unlike the other lost heroes, he was yet to be defined by a mountain of his life's work. Who he really was is indeed complicated. Bobby Kennedy had many personas. It seems quite inconsistent with the image of a thoroughgoing liberal that he worked for Senator Joe McCarthy in the regrettable Red Scare witch hunts of the 1950s. When his brother, the president, hired his little brother Bobby as attorney general, the powerful leader of the Senate, then Vice President Lyndon Johnson, and Bobby rather venomously hated each other. And Bobby finally turned against the war and jumped in as leader of the movement only years after it had already gained a lot of steam. Of course, many saw him as a blatant opportunist after Eugene McCarthy had done the tremendous hard work of organizing and softening up the president when Bobby then announced his own run for the presidency in the spring of '68. I have long wondered what changed Bobby Kennedy from crusading anti-communist to his current status as liberal icon. Well, there is a new book which may finally answer that question. It's called Delta Epiphany, Robert Kennedy in Mississippi. And I'm very pleased to have with us author Ellen Meacham. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Bert. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, Ellen Meacham, and I hope I pronounced it right. Meacham, not Meacham?
Well, it's close. Meacham, yes.
Meacham. All right. Ellen Meacham has been a journalist for more than 20 years. Her work has appeared in the New York Times and many other places. Currently, she teaches journalism at the University of Mississippi. Meacham worked as a news reporter in North Mississippi at the Charleston and at the Charleston, South Carolina Post and Courier. In 2005, she was named American Press Institute Fellow and served her fellowship in the Baton Rouge Advocate. In February 2012, she moderated a panel discussion with journalists and activists who made the trip with Kennedy, including Marion Wright Edelman for the Overby Center for Southern Journalism and Politics. Now, again, thanks for being with us. There are a number of books about Bobby Kennedy, most recently by Chris Matthews and Larry Tye. Netflix has a new documentary about Bobby Kennedy. What was your purpose, Ellen, in writing this book? How did it come about?
Well, it came about I have a colleague on our journalism faculty, Curtis Wilkie, who was a longtime reporter for the Boston Globe, covered the Reagan White House, and was bureau chief for in the Middle East, and covered the Romanian Revolution, just all kinds of fall of the Iron Curtain and fall of communism, and you know, just had an amazing career.
Yes, he did.
Covered every presidential election since 68. But he started, he was a Mississippian originally, and he started his first job at the Clarksdale Press Register, which is a town in the Mississippi Delta. And he wrote a memoir of his time, because he covered a lot of civil rights figures when they were there and later. And he had about a page in the book about being in the cabin with Robert Kennedy when he got down on the floor with this child that was so destitute and tried to get a response from him, very listless. And I was just so struck by that image of this sort of son of power and privilege in this dark place, because I'd been a reporter in Mississippi, and I knew what some of those places were like even 20, 30 years later, 40 years later. And so the image just stayed with me. And since I'm calling from outside Oxford, Mississippi, I have to, I think I'm required to quote Faulkner at least once in the interview. So William Faulkner said that good stories start with a single image or a memory. And so that was what it was. That was that image struck me. And so my first thought was, what kind of impact did it have on Robert Kennedy? This, because I kind of vaguely had this sense that it was in, I'd heard about it before, kind of in popular culture a little bit, but didn't know that much about it. And my very second thought was, what happened to that baby? And what happened to the child? Because I thought that what had happened to him might be a good way to look at what's happened to the Delta since. And I initially thought of it as maybe just a magazine article. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized how it was featured in all of his biographies, some of the ones you've mentioned, Larry Tye, and others, as a pivotal moment in his growth. And as he was looking at poverty, it was kind of a crystallization, I think. It wasn't that it just that he went down there and he wasn't interested and then suddenly he was, but I think it gave him a sense of urgency
that
he didn't quite have before.
I can just imagine. It's one thing to read about and to look at the facts and figures and statistics. But, you know, I know everybody knows from personal experience, when you actually see something and experience it, it can be quite eye-opening. And the word epiphany, I note the former governor of Mississippi, William Winter, remarked that the trip that Bobby Kennedy made to that state was also an epiphany for him and a great many white Mississippians. What brought then-Senator Bobby Kennedy to Mississippi in April of 67? According to your book, the reaction he shared with the wife of an aide was quite a reaction. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Right, right. And it's kind of where I got the title. And actually, Taylor Branch had, in his great biography of Martin Luther King, had touched on this kind of as a parallel journey as Robert Kennedy, and he mentioned the word epiphany. But it came from this quote that Amanda Burden, who was the wife of Kennedy's aide, Carter Burden at the time, said she saw him. She was a young, they were a young couple, and they were working out of Kennedy's New York office, and Kennedy came the very next night after he got back from Mississippi, and he sort of grabbed her by the hands and said, "You don't know what I've just seen. You don't know what I've just seen. Everything I've done has been worthless." And when I read that quote, I thought, my goodness, that seems like a bit of an overreaction, because Kennedy was not a, he was an empathetic person, but he wasn't, you know, someone who went around being emotional all the time. So that really piqued my curiosity, and that's kind of what I got, where I got the idea of Delta Epiphany, because and as I looked into it, it was kind of an epiphany for several people, as they went through these 48 hours in Mississippi and started seeing things a little differently, or a lot differently.
Well, of course, I'm curious how the Delta is these days, but back to April of 67. You know, he was senator. He became senator, I believe it was in 64, was it?
He ran in 64 and was elected in 65. Started serving. Right. He was elected in 64 and started serving in 65. And it was about 2.5 years into the war on poverty. He was serving on a Senate subcommittee on employment, manpower, and labor. And he was. They were looking at some of the programs and holding hearings to see how successful they were. Some of them were up for renewal or for tweaking, change. And so they were planning a series of hearings. And they had one in Washington and decided to go to Mississippi for the first one after hearing testimony from young NAACP lawyer, African-American woman, Marion Wright, who later became Marion Wright Edelman.
So he wanted, this was a focus at the time. I remember the war on poverty. Boy, that was a long time ago. I don't know. Well, let us, before we get too far into the past, how is the Delta now, the Mississippi? You know, there's been a lot of years. Different programs have come and gone. How is poverty now as compared to how it was 50 years ago?
Well, the Delta is still an economically depressed area. And for those of your listeners who, you know, everybody, we sort of hear about the Delta bit. It's the north. It's about 18-county area along the Mississippi River for about 200 miles, the northwest part of the state, up to the Tennessee state line, from about Vicksburg to the Tennessee state line. And, there are still counties there that are some of the poorest in the nation, or where you have as many as, 30% of the children or more in food insecure households. I think one of the counties is about 42% Holmes County. And so you still have children who are not getting enough to eat on a regular basis, and they've changed that sort of food insecure measurement, which means that they may not be hungry throughout the entire month, but they run out of food at the end of the month, or there are times when they can't get enough, or they go hungry. So I kind of want to thread the needle carefully, because so much of the rhetoric often about the war on poverty is, it was just a waste of money, and that's not true.
No.
There have been some significant improvements in sort of the situation for many children compared to the children he saw in 67. In 67, counties could still opt out of the federal school lunch program. Mm. And so the children he saw were not getting free or reduced price lunches at school. They weren't getting them breakfast. Now you can get that and breakfast very often. There are summer feeding programs. One of the things that grew out of a lot of the discussion, it's hard to draw like a direct line to Robert Kennedy's visit to Mississippi, but it opened up the discussion that later led to WIC, which is a food nutritional program for women, infants, and children.
Yes.
So there's some, but the Delta is still very economically struggling. There are some bright spots, though, and there's some programs that are working, but one of the big problems is that Mississippi has never in its history taken serious its commitment to educating all of its children. And so because much of that land is so fertile, some of the most fertile places in America, in the world, the Delta is one of the most fertile places in the world, the land's still really valuable for agriculture, but you can farm a big farm with, half a dozen people now and machinery.
Right.
So there's not a lot of jobs there, and it's struggling like a lot of rural places to keep services and keep some of these small towns open and functioning and getting health care, or there's food deserts, and because the workforce is not particularly skilled, they've lost a lot through some globalization, and just like that's happening everywhere else.
Yeah.
But because the people were already in a difficult, unprepared kind of situation, then it's hit them harder than maybe in some other places.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a big group effort, I'll tell you. And we're speaking with Ellen B. Meacham. The book is Delta Epiphany, Robert F. Kennedy in Mississippi. And on the cover is Senator Kennedy talking with some of the people from Mississippi. And as we say, you know, it was an epiphany. And I did want to say one thing about the Delta that is tremendously prized the world over, Delta blues music. But there's only so many.
That's right.
There's only so many people who can make a living from that, let's face it.
Right. Well, and that's one of the bright spots has been the fact that it is so well known the world over, and they've done a really great job of. There's a Delta Blues Museum, which, if anybody comes to visit, is amazing exploration of blues as the roots of American music. And, you know, so there are, we get a lot of tourists from Japan and other places that specifically come to America to see the Delta. So that is a bit of a bright spot. But again, like you said, only so many people can work, even in spinoff jobs for that. And they're service kind of jobs, you know, that don't pay a whole lot.
Well, what were, I mean, the civil rights movement had been going on for, you know, about a decade before Senator Kennedy's trip in 67. I wonder if you could tell us about some of the institutional obstacles that he learned of that were affecting lives of the deeply impoverished black people there. As you said, education was not a priority. Well, any other institutional obstacles that he discovered while there?
Well, yes, there were quite a few. You know, the system in the Delta had been set up specifically to exploit first free labor, although it wasn't actually developed that much until after the Civil War, but to exploit the African American, the newly freed enslaved people, it was set up to get as much work out of those folks with as little expense on labor and labor cost as possible. And because of the factor of race figuring in, they were able to build a system of racial discrimination, exploitation with the implementation of Jim Crow laws, which completely shut African Americans out of, or just about completely, a few with maybe very small percentage still participating. So there was no way that they could participate in what we know as democracy. They couldn't vote, so they couldn't elect anybody from the school board. They couldn't elect anybody on the couldn't elect the senator, and all of those people did not see themselves as representing that part of the citizenry, or even see them as full citizens. Wow. Now they may have taken, you know, it ran the spectrum some. There were certainly some leaders who saw their responsibility as a kind of paternalistic responsibility, you know, or pressed for, and there certainly were some that pressed for more money to be spent on the separate, quote-unquote, but equal schools and so forth. But overall, the system, the whole society was built to take advantage of these people, because cotton was a highly labor-intensive farming practice. And so there was, so that was one of the obstacles, is that they couldn't vote, you know, and they couldn't make lives for themselves or their children any better, other than just the small things you can do within your own home.
And that's one thing that I doubt most white people even consider, that we just take for granted that we are citizens, we can participate. You know, the politicians don't always do what we want, but we have the right to participate. But if you're shut out completely, if you are merely a subject and not a citizen, that's a pretty significant, you know, obstacle to bringing needed change into your area, because it's all done to you. And as you say, you know, there was a little bit of paternalistic stuff here and there, but not quite the same. One of the more...
No. And as Peter Edelman mentioned when he reviewed my book, and he was Kennedy's aide, he used the word feudalism, and I think that in some ways was pretty apt, a pretty apt description of kind of how it functioned. And race, the whole issue of race and white supremacy made it much more intensely devastating, and so much easier, in a sense, for the the powerful to oppress the powerless, when you've got this marker of race and this kind of edifice that you've built about around the lie of white supremacy, then it makes it easy to do propaganda with it, and you know, and then of course when African Americans especially came back from World War II and had, I don't want to make it sound like they were just passive victims. They had a lot of agency, and a lot of them were very courageous and started asking for their right, not asking, but demanding
yes.
their rights for citizens, as citizens that they had just fought for in World War II. And oftentimes, first the leaders reacted in institutional ways of blocking them, and then when that wasn't working, then violence would erupt and terrible, horrible kinds of what we would consider today or terrorism, where you target a few people as an example to terrorize the rest of the group. So that was an obstacle, an institutional kind of obstacle. The good news is that Mississippi now has more elected African-American officials than any other state in the Union.
Yeah, it's interesting to take on racism quite directly because, you know, when people thought of the Deep South, you'd think of, you know, overt racism. It's, you know, it's in a way it's sort of easier to address, I can imagine, than, you know, in the North where it's more subtle. People pretend it's not there. It is there for sure.
Well, yes, and somebody I was talking to the other day in an interview, you know, asked me, he didn't quite put it this way, but he sort of why are you in Mississippi? Why do you stay in Mississippi? Mm. I'm not a native of Mississippi, and I'm a native of around Nashville, Tennessee. But if you only look at the institutional history of Mississippi, yes, it is a horrible history. But if you look at the mirror image of that, which is the courage and the intelligence and perseverance of the African American population and some of the other folks who allied themselves with them, the white and progressives, then it's an amazing, inspiring history. It's one of the most interesting in the country, I think. So, and I think that, too, one of the interesting things about being here is that we're wrestling with it every day. Mm. You know, Oxford, where I live, is a bit of an oasis. It's a university town. But it's still a question of, you know, they've talked about the burden of Southern history. It's still something that we are constantly trying to wrestle with and work out and talk about. And I don't think that in some parts of the country that is as much on the top of the agenda to discuss.
Yeah, it's true. And one of the, you know, the things about America that the world loves is the bravery, the courage, you know, and you know, courage and bravery comes out when you got a bad situation. And it's incredibly impressive. And one of the unique factors in your book is tracking down the people that Bobby Kennedy met when they were little kids. You tracked down three people: Catherine Wilson, Charlie Dillard, and Brenda Luckett. Bobby Kennedy met them as children during his 67 trip. That must be an interesting
story. Right, right. And also David White. The three of them were older and had a memory of it. David White was actually the baby who was there on the floor.
Yeah.
Toddler. So I sort of try to profile them. And yes, that was, I'm sorry, what was your question?
How did
I do that?
Yeah, how did you do that? There must have been quite a story to track them
well,
down.
Well, it took me quite a while. But, you know, because I knew the terrain a little bit as a, you know, beginning reporter, I had worked in North Mississippi, I understood kind of the interactions and the institutions. So I started with, first I just went through the articles written at the time, and I tried to look at every newspaper in every town that he visited, every local paper and the national coverage. And not every paper, one of the reasons I felt like it was so important to write about these children and their families is very often at the time, even some of the national ones would just say, Kennedy spoke with a Negro woman, which is the word that they used.
Oh, yes, that's
then,
true.
Or a Negro man. They didn't even say their names. They didn't. A few of them, like Curtis Wilkie, my colleague who went on to the book, and others did include details, more details about where they lived and what their names were. And so I made a list, and then I would just go over there. A lot of them, you know, those neighborhoods had been knocked down and replaced. But some of them I found. Catherine Wilson, I just knocked on doors and found her. I went out to Freedom Village, and she's still there, pretty much not too far from where Kennedy met her, and in rural Washington County. And then the others, tried to follow whatever thread that I could, and talk to this person who referred me to that person who referred me to someone else. I talked to deputy sheriffs who served papers and knew everybody in the county,
sure.
You know, and I talked to church secretaries, and I put a little ad in the newspaper, and, you know.
So how solid were their memories? It was 50 years ago, 51 years ago. How solid were they?
Well, you know, this was a pretty big deal, so it was something that they did remember. Catherine Wilson was amazing. She was older, though. She was about 17, I think, when he came. She was a teenager. But everything she told me about her life up to that point, and she was part of a group that the Delta Ministry was working with, which was a civil rights and poverty group that was funded in part by the National Council of Churches. She had everything she told me matched up perfectly with the historical record, you know, any papers that I had. And Charlie Dillard, he was 9 years old, and it was really a big deal. I mean, it was a big deal when he shook hands with Robert Kennedy, because a white man walking up, much less a senator walking up and shaking hands with a poor African-American boy, was just unheard of. That was the first time a white man had ever shaken his hand.
Mm. I understand.
So their memory, and I really wanted to know a lot about what life was like in there, so I could get the, like, if they didn't have that strong a memory of what actually happened with Robert Kennedy, other than a few impressions,
sure.
there was film, video of a lot of it. There were newspaper accounts, but what I really wanted to know was what was life like in that cabin.
Right.
Before he came and after he came, and what did, and so they were really generous to share their stories with me and tell their stories, and I tried to make sure, because I was a white person telling the story of people of color, I tried to make sure that gave them a lot of set, you know. I explained to them exactly what I was doing, what it was to write a book for an academic press versus, even though I was writing it for a commercial audience, but writing for an academic press is a much different kind of animal. It's not like I was, you know, going to make a huge rich. I wasn't going to get rich off an academic book, but I tried to make sure that they understood everything. I would be as upfront as possible, and I shared. They didn't know that their families had been mentioned in news coverage at the time. The guy who was the baby on the floor, he didn't know. He knew that Robert Kennedy had come to the house, but he did not know he was mentioned in all of those biographies as a baby.
Well, once again, just sort of being shut out of it all. There were that Charlie Dillard was 9. What was his reaction? What did he tell Senator Kennedy when he asked him what he had eaten that day? That's an interesting little tidbit.
Right. He said, I believe he's the one that said molasses. Or hadn't eaten lunch. They hadn't eaten lunch yet, and they asked him what he had for breakfast. I think he'd had molasses for breakfast. And it was about 3, it was after school, so it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so Kennedy says, you haven't had lunch yet? And then he says, well, what did you have for breakfast? And so then he goes in and asks their grandmother, and this was a little clip that I found that was sort of some outtakes. It wasn't part of the news coverage, but that I uncovered and interview with where Kennedy goes into the screened-in porch where Mrs. Dillard, Fannie Dillard, is there, and he says, well, what did you feed him? So there's 15 people living in this two-room shack, her grandchildren and some of her other own children and other children, And she says, I can't give him more than two meals a day. I didn't give him any lunch because I can't give him more than two meals a day.
How did
you can just see his reaction, you know, on his face. Just he bites his lip and is stunned, but trying not to look that way, you know, to still interact with her.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to show pity for people. You know, they don't want to be pitied. How did he come across this particular cabin? I mean, somebody must have steered him to it.
Right. Well, after they had the hearing, he was there. It was really kind of a very intense trip. He must have been exhausted when he got back because it was there for 48 hours, just over 48 hours. And he landed in Jackson. And these people were protesting against him, and law enforcement people said that they were connected with the KKK.
Oh my.
They weren't dressed out in the, you know, as the Klan, but they were passing out newsletters and things that were predicting Bobby Kennedy's death, and criticizing him for speaking out against Vietnam. And so there's lots of security. Everybody's worried about his safety, and they have the hearings the next day. In Jackson, he has a very intense day. He goes and gives an impromptu speech at a white Methodist college there at lunch, and then he goes and gives another impromptu speech at a historically black college, Tougaloo College, which is very active in the civil rights movement, and gives that in the evening, and then he goes to dinner, and then, you know, he goes on. And then the next morning they get up and fly to the Delta. And there were some people, Ken Dean, and who was people who were advocates, and Marion Wright, of course, and there were some things on the itinerary that were specifically set up for the war on poverty, you know, like job training programs and at schools and things that were official part of what he was looking at. But he wanted to see the homes of the poor, and so Amzie Moore, who was a civil rights advocate who worked with Martin Luther King and all kinds of folks, just a stalwart there in Cleveland in Bolivar County, he knew where the poorest people were, and that was in this East End part of. So the people on the ground that were working, they suggested places. But the thing that interested me is Kennedy didn't want to just be led around and shown what people wanted him to see. He made unscheduled stops and asked people, went in houses that weren't on the list, and asked the same questions and got many of the same answers. But he also asked one of the journalists the night before, he's like, which one of these advocates can I trust? Who exaggerates? Who, you know, manipulates?
Right.
Daniel Shore, the reporter at the time, likened his demeanor as that of an inspector general. So, you know, he wasn't like what you think of today where some celebrity goes in and gets down and says, look at all these poor people, and which is a fine thing to draw attention to it. But he was much more interested in what is working, what is not working, what is the truth of the matter.
Wow, that's a good thing to find out, the truth and not the myth. One of the children, as you mentioned, Catherine Wilson, was a teenager. What did she tell you? You spoke with her, I guess, for a while about the poverty she and her family experienced. And she also, I guess, talked about her family's involvement in the Freedom Schools and other efforts to remake Mississippi. What price did they pay for this civil rights work? That must have been interesting revelations for you.
Yes, she's an amazing, amazing person. And she told her story is quite compelling. By the time Kennedy had arrived, her mother had worked in Head Start. They had had crosses burned in their yard. They'd had to leave town because they were threat. The freedom during Freedom Summer, when African Americans were really working in the civil rights movement to get more of their rights as citizens. So there was a movement of white college students that came down.
Yes.
And they held things like freedom schools. And one of those groups of people that came during Freedom Summer, they stayed in a house near the Wilsons, and the house where they stayed didn't have any water. So they asked her brother, they paid him to bring them water from their spigot or whatever. And so then that's how they got to know him, and then they went to the freedom schools, and that was the first time Catherine had ever heard about the Constitution or heard about rights as a citizen, and had, and you know, and suddenly she, and her mother too, and her mother got extremely, very inspired by what she was learning, and then the people that she encountered that were part of this movement, African-American and white. And so she started working with them, but that put them in danger. Hmm. So they left there. They were displaced from their farm day work too at this time because of economic factors. And she had marched with, by the time she was 17, she had marched with Martin Luther King. She had integrated a school. She had integrated, done a sort of a sit-in in the library in Indianola, Mississippi. She'd been in jail. She had been through so much, and Freedom City there, and Freedom Village, and it's called Freedom Village now, but at the time it was called Freedom City. It was an effort to find a way for displaced farm workers that were had been needed in the cotton fields that weren't, because of a lot of factors, mechanization and herbicide, pre-emergent herbicide, which eliminated the need to chop cotton, the weeds around cotton. And so she, they really didn't have any, too many choices. They had no skills, the displaced farm workers, other than farming, really. And there were some job training, but not enough of it. So they could either leave and go to the cities that were already overwhelmed by some of the migration, or they could stay, and not everybody could leave or even wanted to leave. So the Delta Ministry had worked with some grants and some other things to try to set up this sort of cooperative farm where they would own their own houses and a little bit of land, and then they would farm as a corporation. They would own the rest of the land and farm it, and they had a workshop and a Head Start. You know, it was a very inspiring kind of vision, but it worked pretty well for a while. There's a book called Divine Agitators, which is a great history of that. It's fallen in disrepair.
Yeah, well, that's we have to figure out what we can do. I mean, it's going to get tougher in the future with more and more mechanization and artificial intelligence and stuff, but that's topic for another show. So this was 1967, and just before that, you know, Lyndon Johnson was able to pass the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. But to be a Southern Democratic senator before that, anyway, I'm not sure about after that, the passage of those laws, to be a Southern Democratic senator meant being an avowed racist dedicated to preserving Jim Crow and institutional racism. So here was Senator Kennedy from the North coming down to their territory. How did the other senators react to that? I know this will come as a shock, but every now and then in politics there are egos involved.
Exactly. Well, the unusual thing is that Senator Eastland from Mississippi and Senator Kennedy actually had a pretty good friendship behind the scenes, even though they disagreed with each other on just about everything. They did agree, and they did. You got to remember too, it was the Cold War, so some of these folks would agree with things internationally that needed to be done. And Kennedy was, you know, kind of part of the came out of that Cold War idea. So he had, but it would have been politically dangerous for both of them for it to be well known that they were friends behind the scenes. But publicly, at least, Eastland said, you know, is this gross libel? There's, you know, this is not, people aren't starving. And they really seized upon, and then, of course, the governor and local and state officials reacted extremely defensively aggressively, and criticized Kennedy, and, you know, sort of, how dare he come down here? And one of the newspaper editors came around the corner in Cleveland, Mississippi, and said, what the hell are you doing here, Senator Kennedy? Why don't you go back to Harlem? Because he represented New York. You've got plenty of poverty up there. Why are you coming down here? Why are you making us look bad? Why are you going to the worst part of town? Why don't you go to, I can show you some nice parts of the town. So they were they really resented it and put out all kinds of statements, you know, accused him of being political. It wasn't partisan because at that time they were conservatives, but
right.
they were Democrats, and
right.
he was a Democrat. But they accused him of trying to get, you know, votes and all kinds of things. But one thing that's interesting in the rhetoric, though, they pretty much denied it, the senators did, is that Kennedy always stayed, he didn't do any name-calling, which is really different from today. He stayed on the ideas and issues. And he said, he kept saying, this is an American problem. This is not a Mississippi problem. These are American children. And so we as Americans have a responsibility to make sure that they're fed. And he was very careful not to just cast it as all these baby starvers down here in Mississippi. My father was born about the same time Kennedy was, and he would always tell me, and was a lawyer too, focus on what's right, not who's right. And I was struck by Kennedy on how much he did that. Now, privately, he may have had a lot more other things to say, but at least his public statements focused on the ideas and not fault. Let's fix this, and here we ought to fix it. It's we can't. He even said in one of his speeches during his presidential campaign, he talked about what he'd seen in Mississippi. He said, you know, we can't live up to the principles that our country was founded on 200 years ago if we cannot feed our own children. America does not live up to her principles. So that was, to me, you know, you don't hear that kind of people talking like that. And he left the door open enough that Stennis, after a second round of hearings in which publicly he had been in denial in Washington and kind of huffing and puffing, a week or two later, after people holding up those reports and showing the photographs and Kennedy saying, you know, don't you think that we need to do something about this? Stennis calls up and offers $10 million in emergency food aid as part of the bill he was working on. And Kennedy's aide said, oh, this is outrageous. It's just a pittance. You know, it's too little, too late kind of idea.
Yeah.
And Kennedy said, wait, we will take it. We will say thank you. People won't say we're selling out, and we will build on it, you know.
Interesting. That was a smart move. Well, certainly, you know, no politician does anything which isn't meant to be noticed by as wide a public as possible. It's just reality. And obviously the press in Mississippi, you know, were not real favorable toward Senator Kennedy. But tell us about the congressional hearings, what that was all about. That followed fairly closely after the trip. What were they trying to do, and what difference might they have made in the issues that Senator Kennedy discovered?
Well, one thing that Kennedy's trip did was move the conversation from poverty, which is a kind of moving target and different in everybody's mind. You know, we'd all draw a different picture of it probably if we sat down to draw slightly different, or maybe some commonalities. But hunger is is this visceral kind of thing that we've all experienced in one way or another, and hungry children. And so because he went there, you know, a lot of other media outlets are looking around and doing more coverage of the problem. And if you think about, you know, in post-war America, there was so much of the focus of popular culture. There weren't as many opportunities to see. You know, you had three channels, news media. Much of what Americans saw about themselves was this booming post-war economy. And so the images they saw were shocking. And I think that's one reason why it was remembered so. And so then the press began to expand their coverage, and Kennedy went on to Eastern Kentucky with the Senate subcommittee, and they went to some Native American reservations in California and saw it again. You know, everywhere he went after that, he went off the beaten path and would seek out families and ask them questions unscheduled. Image. So the hearings that they had, they sent Field Foundation director, saw the coverage of Kennedy's visit in the New York Times. And so they had been thinking about this, and they were already aware of some of the problems. And so he called up Dr. Robert Coles and some other folks and some other doctors and asked them to make a trip, an investigative trip down to Mississippi and just sort of examine and get it, make a report. They came back with a devastating report. And when they went to the Secretary of Agriculture, they didn't have any much luck. You know, his hands were kind of tied by a powerful congressman, who Jamie Whitten, who ironically represented at that time a big part of the Delta. So Kennedy said, okay, we'll have some hearings. July, that got a lot of coverage, and Mississippi tried to send some officials to answer some of the charges, but Kennedy was very adept because, you know, he had been in so many of those hearings as with Jimmy Hoffa and other folks. He was very adept at being prepared and challenging these assertions, and he really just kind of knocked them back on their heels. They didn't have any much left to say. And, you know, the coverage of that and the documentation that came out of that, you know, continues the discussion. And it's hard to draw a direct line to say, oh, he went to Mississippi and then this X policy happened.
Sure.
Because that's not how the sausage is made, as you know. Oh. But he kept pushing. At that time, you had to buy them for a certain amount on the dollar. They had no exceptions for people with no income because they didn't believe there were any people in America with no income.
Wow.
And Kennedy said, I just met them yesterday. So they did get that exception for some people, and then they took a whole full year to get emergency, quote-unquote, food aid from the government to the Delta. Kennedy got some of the foundation. Pretty sure he had some sent from his own pocket, but I didn't actually find any absolute documentation on that, just some word-of-mouth stuff.
The book is called Delta Epiphany, Robert Kennedy in Mississippi. We're speaking with its author, Ellen B. Meacham. And it does seem like it was a pivotal point where, you know, consciousness has to be raised. And once it is raised, things do eventually change. But one of the things that the right wing likes to say is, oh, liberals, they're all about the federal government stepping in and, you know, stepping over local and state government and you know, doing what they want. They're imposing a solution from the top down. Kennedy's vision was a bit different from that. What was his idea of fixing the problem? My sense is it was more complex and nuanced than, you know, the federal government just, you know, overstepping.
Right, right. It was. It was more complex and nuanced, and that's a good way to put it. And he had had some success with an urban poverty work that he had been involved with, where it was a public-private partnership, and it was sort of a three-pronged approach with charities and some public money and public efforts to create enterprise zones and things, and private enterprise, some businesses making commitments to do things in that area. And that really was a model, and it's been replicated all over. It's still, you know, it's still there today. So the other thing was part of the early war on poverty was this thing called community action, and it required input from the people being served about what they needed. And part of that meant that if the state refused to, say, apply for available funds for Head Start, which is what Mississippi did, they said, we're not going to do that. It's a bunch of waste of money, just like they sort of did with Obamacare and expanding Medicaid. If the state or the local people, governments refused to do it, local nonprofit groups could form or corporations could form and apply and get that money, and it would bypass local officials, which was unpopular not just in the South, but a lot of, you know, big city bosses who like to control that money, and, you know, politicians everywhere objected to that, and they later took it out. But for a while, at least in the South, Kennedy saw that Head Start was sort of kind of a revolution for many of these children and their families, and it would never have gone there unless they'd been able to bypass that. So it is kind of a mixed bag, I think. He really came out of that World War II generation where he had seen America come out of the Great Depression. He'd seen America win the war, and he saw it as a problem. We can solve this problem. You know, there's not maybe a one size fits all, but we can do this. It's, you know, it has done a lot. It just hasn't been enough. And there's a safety net there, but it's fraying and it's always under threat. And that is a shame. It doesn't cover enough. It doesn't do enough. But it's better, much better than it was. And part of the message from the right, unfortunately, I think, is that this has been a bunch of waste of money. Let's just throw up our hands. And I kind of feel like that the war on poverty is a wrong metaphor because it sounds like something we might win. I think of it more as a garden that every generation should tend, you know, and we might have to plant things today that we won't, trees we won't get to sit on for under for generations, and we have to get the weeds that other people planted out. But that's why they don't have me make up slogans, because the garden of poverty doesn't sound good at all. But
well, the whole idea of war on this, war on that, enough of that stuff in my mind. Now it seems like sort of a war on the poor themselves.
Right.
That Trump is doing. And you mentioned Marion Wright, who later became Marion Wright Edelman, who's pretty well known, founder, you know, of the, and president of the Children's Defense Fund. Tell us about her testimony to the Senate subcommittee meeting that prompted the Senate delegation to Mississippi. And
she's, in a way, kind of the heroine of the book. And there's also a little bit for your audience. There's also even a little bit of a love story, because she met her husband, Peter Edelman, on that trip. And I don't know that it was exactly love at first sight, but it was, you know, they had a pretty powerful connection from the, you know, the very
nice
day they were riding through the Delta. And so, you know, and they've gone on to spend their life working on behalf of children. And she went up to Washington and said to those senators up there, she was there to testify on behalf of Head Start, because it was under attack, of course, by official Mississippi officials. They said the Stennis had waited, his office had waited 8 days after Head Start opened to start investigating them for impropriety, a whole 8 days. And so she was up there to defend Head Start. She did that, but then she went off topic, and she said later, she said, I'm not even sure why, but I'd been in those homes, and I'd seen how people were suffering, and she just looked at him and said, look, people are hungry, and it's basically a disaster is slowly happening in the Delta, and we don't know how they're going to get food get through the winter. People are begging, and someone must do something about it. And she looked quite directly at them and was very forceful about it. And so they decided to come on down to Mississippi for the hearings, and then the trip to the Delta kind of grew out of the plans from there. And then once they were in the Delta, she was not a fan of Robert Kennedy's at all. She considered him that he had made too many compromises as Attorney General. She thought the Kennedy administration had been a disappointment, because she was on the ground. She had been calling desperately. She knew what it was like to call the FBI office or the Justice Department in those days and say, you know, we've had a bomb threat. Somebody says they're going to shoot us, whatever it is. The firebomb came in our window, and they'll say, well, we'll investigate, or call us when something happens.
Yeah.
We can't do anything till after. But she was pleasantly surprised with her time with him. So it was kind of an epiphany for her, because she felt it like, as she watched him interact with the people and ask questions and spent some time with them during that 48 hours, she became convinced that he was authentically interested in making a difference. And that really turned her opinion around.
Interesting. Yeah, he did go through a bunch of changes in his life. And sometimes, you know, let's face it, his authenticity has been questioned. And President Johnson and he were not good friends, shall we say. President Johnson had a rather cynical interpretation of Bobby Kennedy's attention to poverty. Tell us about that.
Whole books have been written about their bad, the bad blood between Johnson and Kennedy. And I think that was one of probably both of their serious flaws, is they could not get past their dislike for each other to work together on something they were both interested in. And so Johnson saw Kennedy as being an opportunist and trying to make him look bad, because the war on poverty was his sort of way of trying to step out of the Kennedy shadow after sort of carrying on with civil rights, at least under the guise of carrying on JFK's civil rights proposals. Johnson had wanted to kind of establish his own legacy. He was a huge fan of Franklin Roosevelt, and so he was trying to sort of be in part of that legacy. And he saw Robert Kennedy, as trying to highlight programs and make him look bad, you know, punch holes in what he had been trying to do.
Well, it reminds me of what your dad said. It's not who's right, it's what's right. I like that.
That's right.
That's very good. What do you think just a couple minutes here. What would Bobby Kennedy say, you know, if he could see Mississippi, how it looks now, how the rest of the nation with this suddenly unleashed blatant racism?
Well, I think he would be quite astonished and discouraged, disheartened. I think that it seemed like such a, he wouldn't have used these terms, but such a no-brainer to him, you know, that he was just astonished. He wasn't naive, but he was surprised that it was so hard to get people in Washington to be motivated to fix it back then. And now I think that he would be really upset to see how hard they have to work to try to just protect some of the things that are working.
Yeah.
But he was a data guy. He wanted measurements and outcomes, and he looked at those things. He was quite annoyed when he went to one of the places in Greenville, and the director couldn't tell him how many people had actually gotten jobs through the training program or how many jobs there were in the county. And he was quite curt and short with him about that. So he wasn't a fan of programs just for program's sake. As compassionate he was for children, and even his enemies acknowledged that, and he was not a perfect saint by any means.
No.
He had flaws. But I think he would be just shocked that people weren't moved by the plight of America's children today.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Well, the book is Delta Epiphany. Great title. Robert F. Kennedy in Mississippi. Ellen Meacham is the author, and it's put out by University Press of Mississippi. Thanks so much. I wish we had made more progress than we have, but we got the ball rolling.
Got to keep going. My website is ellenmeacham.com, the usual place.
Of course. All right. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll see if we can keep democracy alive.
Thank you so much, Bert. Right,
thank you. Maybe we can see if we can keep the winds of change, give them some more air. You got the push going? You got to keep it going. Thanks so much for listening.
Great. Thank you.